This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome back to New Books in Hindu Studies. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkran. Today, I have the distinct pleasure of speaking with Archana Venkatesan of UC Davis on an exciting translation of an ancient Tamil poem. Archana, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Endless Song, as listeners will see on this podcast. What is it a translation of?
So, the translation is the of the late 8th or 9th century poem by the great Tamil mystic and poet Nammalvar. He was a Vaishnava poet, and he composed four poems, of which this is the crown jewel, if you will. It's 1,102 verses long, and it is called the Thiruvaimuri, which literally means the sacred utterance or the sacred truth. It's translated as Endless Song, partly as a metaphor that the song, the song, the topic of which is the yearning for union with Vishnu, is a sort of eternal, endless quest. But it's also referring to the actual format of the poem, which is in this very unique, form called the andadi, where every last syllable is linked to the following verse's next syllable. So it's done through homonyms, using words, sometimes just the syllable. So in effect, the first word of the poem, which is uyar, high, is also the poem's last word, uyar. So it essentially forms a kind of garland. So the poem is endless in this sense. So the title of the English title of the poem, of the translation, Endless Song, is kind of a reference to both of those aspects.
I will certainly hopefully get a taste for this exquisite Tamil poetry in your fantastic English translation. And there's so much to be said about what can and can't be translated. Tell us a little bit more about the world behind the text in terms of the context that we know of giving rise to this work. And then maybe you can tell us a little bit about the world in front of the text in terms of how it's used today.
So the that's a wonderful way to kind of actually think about this text, because we don't know very much historically about the poet. He refers to himself in the poems, in these halashrutis, these last concluding verses, which is, so the structure of the poem is that it's sort of like almost like Inception, or like a Russian doll, one something within something within something else, which is also that endless quality of the poem. So the poem has sets of 10 or 11 verses, where the 11th verse is always the palace repeat. Those sets of 10 are themselves set into sets of 100. And there are 10 such books, which is what gives us the 1100 count. So in each of these Phalashruti verses, the poet refers to himself, and this is where we get whatever little bit of biographical, historical information about him. So we know from these Phalashrutis that he his name was Shatakopan. He has a title, Maran, so he sometimes refers to himself as Maran Shatakopan. Which is a reference to a title associated with the Pandya kings, because it's something that the Pandya kings use. So we know that he probably had some kind of a relationship to the kings of that area. He was from the very, very deep south of India. And today it's associated with the town of Aalwar Tirunagiri, which is in Tirunelveli, Thoothukudi district in Tirunelveli area. And he refers to this town and he praises it in his poems as a very wealthy, prosperous town filled with virtuous Brahmins and virtuous people who maintain the Vedic fires and so on and so forth. So this is the information we get from the poem that is historical. But the poem gives us other kinds of information. For instance, we know that he is an extraordinary poet. So he's one of these poets that comes once in a blue moon, just incredibly talented with a wonderful sense of sound and rhythm and language. The language is simple, but the simplicity, it's sort of like the Hemingway simplicity. There is such depth and texture to the simplicity of the words. In addition, we know that he was also extremely erudite. The poems are deeply philosophical, mystical as well, and they are also poems inflected. So he knew they are full of references to Sanskrit texts and mythological references and so forth. So he is somebody who was clearly very, very well educated, both in terms of his command over the literary techniques in terms of his ability to innovate and experiment, as well as just in terms of the theological sort of grasp and his ability to then translate that theology into a poetry that's very deeply felt and moving. So the poem is part of this. So it eventually becomes incorporated into this canon of 4,000 verses called Vinayalaya Divya Prabandham, which is equivalent to the Tamil Veda. Specifically, the Thiruvaimuri is given the status of the Veda, and it's referred to as the Dravida Veda or the Southern Veda. And it comes to be incorporated probably beginning soon after his lifetime, probably starting around the 10th or 11th century, and almost immediately comes to be revered by the nascent Sri Vaishnava community. And so you begin to see lots and lots of commentaries about the poem, trying to get some sense and some handle on how to read this poem. It continues to be, it's a very, very important poem to the Sri Vaishnavas. In fact, there is a annual festival of recitation that takes place every December. That's 11 days or 10 days. Some have an 11th day, some temples have an 11th day, which is devoted to the recitation of this text. It always takes place in the month of Margari, which is the end of December, January. So it's a text that has a wonderful and continuing life and is profoundly relevant to particularly to the religious life of Sri Vaishnava.
There's so many points of entry there. The idea that this poem is clearly the product of nothing short of genius.
Yeah.
That this individual, what little we know about him biographically, certain eclipsed by the much we know about him in terms of his ability, by virtue of his grasp, his command, not only of these esoteric and theological concepts, but also there is this sort of vibrancy of feeling. And then on top of that, there is this extraordinary ability to marry his feeling with his insight into language.
Yeah.
And these are various modes of human enterprise where we would be so blessed to have a fraction of any of these traits. And clearly this, you know, he was a Shakespeare of his time and space.
Yes, definitely. I would say that.
And so also the structure, it's, you know, I look at narrative texts, right? And it's dawning on me more and more that there's great meaning embedded in the structure in terms of exegesis or reception.
Right.
And one of the things I look at is sort of, you know, ring composition, where a narrative sort of ends where it begins. And this poem seems to be, in some ways, a ring composition in terms of coming full circle. I mean, are there, would you say of these 10 sections, how are they arranged, if any, or is there any pattern in terms of how they arise?
Okay, so this is the interesting thing about the poem, right? So the exegesis, the commentarial tradition, reads the poem as a journey, a kind of linear journey, where there's a of separation and then union to God. Like it's seen as an autobiographical record of the poet's journey, where he has moments of union and moments of separation. And then the poem ends in this remarkable way in the 10th book. So that's decades 10:9 and 10:10, in which in 10:9, he describes this ascent to Vaikuntha, where he sort of imagines not himself ascending to Vaikuntha, but he imagines what that would look like all the gods are there and people are, and the apsaras are there and people are sprinkling water. And it ends with an audience. And you can sort of imagine a kind of almost early medieval court where Vishnu is in state with Sri, because of course in the Sri Vaishnava tradition, they're inseparable, right? Sri is so crucial as a mediator towards the goal of salvation. So she's there, and the poem sort of, so this is the penultimate decad of the poem. And then in the final decad of the poem, that's the 10th, the 10th hundred, he describes, the poem ends with this marvelous and extraordinary description of being, and actually it's a place where it's sort of grammar breaks down almost, where he talks about like being like iron in water. And so there's a sense of, you don't know who's absorbing the water. So who's God and who's the poet, like who's absorbing, who's eating whom. And it ends with him talking about God enveloping him, like completely surrounding him. And it's this engulfing and engulfing and engulfing. I'm surrounding and surrounding that, and then surrounding that and surrounding that. And then you finally cut even the desire that I have for you and completely take me over. So the tradition reads this as a kind of linear narrative, right? But the poem itself resists it because it has the circular and cyclical quality, not only because of the andadi, where each poem is linked to the other, and the poem ends by taking us back to the beginning. So in some ways, the structure of the poem is both reflective of God's nature, which has neither beginning nor end, the nature of the quest itself, which has neither beginning nor end. It is itself an endless quest, as well as the nature of samsara, which is also endless, right? So all of that is bound in the structure of the poem. And so it's in some ways to, for me personally, I've always found that you have to read a text like this, which is so revered and treasured and has really been nurtured by the Sri Vaishnava community over a very, very long period. You have to take them seriously and you have to read the commentaries alongside the poems. But at the same time, as a scholar, as a translator, for me, there is also a personal independent relationship that I have with the text, where I think it's quite possible to read the text in a different way. So in some ways, you can read, and I think you're meant to read each of the, you know, 10 sets, that is the verses that are, you know, the thematically united sets of 10 verses with the Phalashruti, independently. They stand alone. So, for instance, you will have one set of 10 verses on the site of Srirangam, for instance, or when one set of 10 verses on the site of Tirukurunguri. Or you'll have a set of verses in the mother's voice, wondering about her girl who has wandered off. You might have a set in the voice of the heroine. You might have so they're thematically independent and they stand alone, as well as each set of 100 verses are united by a theme which the acharyas have identified. So, for instance, the first 100 might be seen as describing the nature of God. Second 100 may be described as what is the nature of the way and the path and so on and so forth. So there is a kind of the first 100 does this, the second 100 does this, the third 100 does this, and the fourth 100 does this. So there is a way also to read each 10 separately, each 100 separately, and then reading the poem also as a unit. But the third possibility, and to me the most exciting for us, particularly if you're looking at this as a scholar of literature and of somebody who's interested in poetry, is that the structure of the poem, right, this andadi, the cyclical and circular nature of the poem, allows you to enter the poem at any point and end it at any point. So that means it basically allows endless possibilities for how you can rearrange the poem, right? Say you start at a poem where you begin at sort of the, for instance, if you read the poem backwards, you get a very different experience than if you were reading it from the midpoint on to the end point. Gives you a very different experience. So I think one of the wonders of the poem is the flexibility of its very structure, the possibilities that it gives us as readers, that we can enter, so you don't in some ways need to read it from start to finish, like a novel. You can read it anywhere, and any verse or even any decade stands on its own and is rich and wonderful for that reason.
And it seems that this sort of ornately kaleidoscopic structure, it both mirrors, you know, the beauty and the texture, the depth of the divine that it's talking about. So it's mm-hmm. sort of this synergy of content and form. And what I'm hearing you articulate is that it also mirrors the multitude of paths and experiences towards that divine, such that one can engage, one can arrive at the ocean starting from various points of departure.
Yeah, indeed. In fact, there's a very famous verse that's at the very beginning of the Tiruvaimuri. It's 115, in which he says precisely this. He says it in different ways in other parts of the poem as well, but this is a particularly famous one. And it comes right after the verse that's been made very, very famous by Ikke Ramanujan. So Namarvar is mostly known to people through Raman's translation, Hymns for the Drowning. And this is this particular verse that I'm alluding to is the one in which Raman calls it the paradigm. It's the Naam Avan Ivan Uvan Avan Ivar Ivar Uvar Ivar. You know, the one where he talks about this man and that man and the other in between, that very famous verse. So right after this verse where he says the Naam Avan Ivan Uvan Avar Ivan Uvar Ivar Naam Avar Ivar Uvar Adu Vidu Udu Yedu. He's just basically playing here with, it's just a recitation of pronouns, but it's beautifully done. Veem ivai ya yave avai nalam ting avai aam avai ayave nindra avare. So the one who stands there, who is becoming everything. Now he has the verse that follows right after that is a verse in which he says that everybody has their path. Avar avar tamat tamat arivari vahai vahai. Everybody has their own path. Each person has their own God, and they reach the feet of that God. There is no God who is less. So he says, so there's no God who is less. Whatever the fated way that each person has will be the one that reaches you to this God. So this is a very famous verse in 115. That opens the Tiruvaimuri. So in some ways, the poem is exemplary and exemplifies that principle. Now, this is not to say, I mean, it's a very clearly Vaishnava text. There is no question the poem is not advocating for some kind of very ecumenical sort of like, you know, it has these moments where it says that, you know, all paths, but it's ultimately all paths lead to him, and that him is very clearly Vishnu. And there are all of these moments in the poem where he's subordinating Shiva or the other deities. And there are, for instance, the section that ends the 400 on that in praise of his own hometown, Kurukur, is one of the most polemical of the Tiruvayamuri, where he basically disses and says, all other paths are just wrong. And I can't believe anybody would be following any other paths when you have the possibility of following Vishnu. So it's a poem that, you know, you can certainly bracket out these moments that seem to be speak to us in our sort of more liberal-minded and open-minded. He can certainly do that. But at the same time, there are also other moments in the text where it's very clear that he has a specific agenda, and that agenda is, and he's very much rooted in a Vaishnava worldview. So, yeah.
And it even seems to add credence to the notion that the poem is aiming to be as all encapsulating as the divine it's talking about. It includes these various perspectives within a ultimately stringently Vaishnava theological bent or devotion to a very clear face of the divine. There's nevertheless the beauty of narrative and of poetry, especially, is I feel a number of things, but not least of which is its penchant for preserving paradox and for, mm-hmm. for sort of, you know, A not A, and hold that without worrying about non-contradiction. The other thing that's glorious about poetry is that, unlike prose, where you can get the sense from, for example, your iPad, you don't need lungs to utter prose, but you need lungs to utter poetry. You need the poetry demands an embodied experience of utterance and hearing. Mm-hmm. And so, I would love for you to read. Just recite a verse in the Tamil, and perhaps also your translation, even 115 if you like, or some other that speaks to you, just to give sometimes an...
Let me see. Oh my God, there's so many beautiful verses.
This is why I had intended to choose one, but I cannot begin to.
There are so many beautiful verses.
What first comes to mind?
Oh, the verse... Good. That's hard. Like this is when I'll just read one. Actually, it's a very short verse. It's just a couplet. One of the few that is in couplet form. It's actually a brilliant verse. And it's actually a verse that was very, very hard to translate as well. And this comes in the second decad. The first 102nd decad. And in which he's talking about, when the poem opens, you do not get the identity of Vishnu until the very end of the second decade. So he's only referred to as Avan or Avar, which is just he, right, in the third person, respective and non-respective forms. So you get all of this description about the god without actually getting the name of the god. So in the first, it's sort of the first verse, the first decad, it's sort of giving you a picture of the supreme god, the highest one who is worshipped by the immortals. And then in the second decad, that's 1-1, that is the first 102nd decad, he describes the path, right? How do you get to this god that he's described? So I just want to read out, and this is all in couplets, and it's in a kind of very folky meter. So, and he does this by just using this one word, vida, which means to leave, to let go. So he says, வீடுமின் முற்றவும் வீடு செய்த உம்முயிர் வீடுடைய யானிடை வீடு செய்மினே. I'll just say that again. It's just a couplet. Veedumin mutravum veedum sorry veedumin mutravum veedu seid ummuyir veedudai yanidai veedu seiyine. That's it. It's just such a beautiful verse, and you hear the word veedu 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 over and over again. So veedumin mutravum, before the, you know, it's sort of the veedu means to let go, to leave. So it's hard to translate this into English, because in English it just is like, before letting go something, let go something, 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 let go, and go to the person that owns letting go. That's literally what it sounds like in English. So when I did this intro, so I had to go through multiple versions of this particular verse. Partly I wanted to ensure that the translation kept the brevity of the verse. It was very important to me that, and I felt like the strength of the verse comes from the fact that it is so short and so brief. It had to repeat there had to be repetition of the word. So in English, sometimes that can be very tinny. We don't like repetition like that in English, in English poetry. But I felt like that was very important, that I had to choose a word that would have the same affect in English. I also decided, after going through multiple drafts where I had split the lines in many, many different ways, that it had to ultimately be a couplet as well to reflect it. So the way it ended up in English is this: when you've let go everything, let your life go to him who owns all letting go. So I use the word rather than use vida, which I could have easily done moksha or something of that sort. I chose, or release, I could have done seizing. I tried doing homonyms, like seize, as a way of kind of maybe doing wordplay, and that was just so, that was too precious. So ultimately, I went for a very simple rendition, split into two lines. When you've let go everything, let your life go to him who owns all letting go. And I deliberately left it to be somewhat grammatically unclear as to what was going on. I also removed all punctuation, so you have to figure out, as the reader or the reciter, of where you want to pause in the poem. And so I could have easily done, when you've let go, comma, everything, comma, let your life, comma, go to him who owns all letting go. But I chose very deliberately to leave the everything dangle between the go and the let, as a way of focusing our attention on that and making us as the reader understand what the relationship between each of those parts is. So that is one example of a verse that I personally struggled a lot with. It took me weeks to get it to a place where I felt that it works. And it was, I would say, one of the few verses that I feel very happy about having finished. Like, yes. When I look at that translation, even now after some months, there's nothing there that I would change. Like, I don't look at it and think there's a different way that I could have done this, or it could have been better. For me, that is as good as I was going to get it. But that's not the case with many of the other verses.
Of course, there's certainly a sense of accomplishment in that, you know, as a translator, you're translating much more than semantic meaning.
Right.
So you've already, I think, touched on this in sharing with us your journey with this one verse, but what is it that you hope to render from the poem into English? Obviously a sense of the meaning, but there's much, much more than that that you're doing, isn't there?
Absolutely. For me, I love poetry. For me, it's...
That is evident from any line you read from this. And we will touch on the tension between sort of poetic and analytical modes of being and thinking. But I digress. Please return. You love poetry and...
So I really love poetry. And I think this is an incredible poem. I think it is one of the great, great poems of world literature, if you wouldn't want to use that very problematic category. I think it stands, it's an enormous achievement, literary achievement. And it's unfortunate that it's kind of pigeonholed as this work of you know, Sri Vaishnava literature, and that people feel like they have to have all this background to read the poem and to engage with it. But I think it's a profound poem. I think it's an incredibly beautiful poem. I think it's to me, it is a deeply felt, moving work of art. So for me as a translator, the poetry always comes first. Yes, the theological stuff is important, but I wanted it to work as a poem. It needed, for me, it had to work as a poem on its own. It had to be tangible as that. It had to be able, if somebody reading this with no background in Hinduism, no background in the Vaishnava tradition of the Tamil-speaking South, should still be able to read it and come away with something of the extraordinary quality of the poem. That was, to me, very, very important. So that was what guided me, which is why very often I would have multiple, I mean, this took about 11 years to finish. And I think that's still too short a time. But for me, it was a question of you kind of have to listen to the sounds, because one of the things as a translator is, I think we often think about translation is always some kind of loss. Oh, I can't bring over the Tamar into English. Oh, I'm losing this aspect of the Tamar. But I inhabited that space and always felt the lack. Oh no, like all the things that I could not do in English that the Tamar could do. But over time, I've trained myself to start thinking about translation differently as something that is a creative act in and of itself, that is something that is valuable in and of itself, and not just some kind of facsimile, right? The poor kind of copy. And I've also started to learn to see what is it English and Tamil are as far apart as two languages can possibly be. And you can never bring over Tamil into English in the way that you want, just as you can't bring English into Tamil. It's just not going to be possible. But you have to, I think the problem is when you try to do that. Rather, for me, I have to look at what is it that English does well. What are the resources of English that I can harness to make a Tamil poem speak in English, right? So, and English has wonderful, wonderful resources such as I rhymes, slant rhymes, assonance, consonants, alliteration that works beautifully. I think that gives a certain kind of, removes a bit of that artificiality. So that is kind of what I would look for. So usually the way I work is I will usually do a translation that's a very literal, like word for word, get all the, you know, the grammar correct. And then as I move, you know, through it, I like to go, my preferred style of translation, at least for this poem, is something that is more economical, because his style is very economical. It's very dense. In terms of he's able to pack a lot in with just a very few words. It's, as I said, simple. The Tamar is quite simple. He doesn't use very, you know, complex or difficult words or something of that sort, but the simplicity hides a lot. And so initially I would just work on that, and then over time, I would just keep working on a single verse to get a particular kind of sound. Like I usually would look in the Tamar to see, like, what is the sound? Like in this verse that I read, for instance, Veedamin Mutravum, it's got a very lots of hard consonants. Veedamin Mutravum, Veedase Dumir, Veedurai Yanide, Veedase Nine. It's got a lot of very hard consonants, but it ends with a long vowel, Veedamin Ne. So for me, when I was working on this, I wanted to replicate that, which is why, and I wanted to replicate the doubling, that you see in the summer. So that's why you get the letting go, the let, which brings you the same dental sound, the vd, ta ta in the English. So that is, so that became one way to do it. And it ends with go, with this long vowel. I'm just trying to find the translation. So it also ends with a long vowel, go, just like say mine. So even though I didn't get the A sound, I was still able to get a vowel at the end, which was very important to me. Because it kind of is a, it's an open, it kind of gives that open quality, that letting go is this release in it. It's the sound of the word is itself about the release that he's speaking of. So that's the kind of way that eventually I so it was very painstaking.
Yes, yes, but there's something quite profound in the very process you engage in that from what I can glean, it really bespeaks the enterprise of poetry. Yeah. Insofar as poetry is as much a vessel of ideas too vast to fit within your mind as it is an acoustic, embodied, musical experience. And so, you know, I don't know any Tamil. So when you recite a verse of the poem, my mind, my heart, my being is forced to engage with the acoustic sonic dimension. And there's so much to engage with. There's so much flavor, right? Especially for anyone who's remotely musical, there's so much to engage with.
Yeah.
And so it seems that you're able to register that that dimension, right? Register the flavor. And then somewhere in the back of your brain, you're able to come up with what in English would render a proxy for that flavor for the listener, mm-hmm. while also transplanting some sense of the meaning of the impact.
Yes, yes.
So this
that is not to say the meaning is secondary, but just as for this poet, they're two, the meaning and the poetry and the sound are not, they're intertwined. Just so that too has to be the case when we do the translation work that we do, that sometimes I find in translation, we place that semantic, the emphasis so much on the semantic that getting that meaning, like the literal meaning out, that the poetry is just lost. And then we read it and we think, I can't in English. And we think this person is a great poet, is really worth translating. And then we've really lost something. And so in some ways, my hope in this translation was to give the reader a sense of how both of those things worked in concert. That meaning and poetry and the sound and the rhythm and all of that are not, in fact, it's not that the latter is somehow subordinate to the former, but each is actually constitutive of the other.
It reminds me of that famous Kalidas verse. It talks about the extent to which sound and meaning are like Shiva and Parvati. They're ultimately one, and so of course the meaning is not secondary. The meaning is primary, like the body or the clothing. The body is primary. Nevertheless, it's accentuated in a very different way.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah,
right. If you have a certain lovely body in, just to use a metaphor, in a sari, well, maybe there's no sari in the West, but what garments might equate the sense? Certainly, a beautiful body in a nice pair of jeans and a t-shirt won't quite translate the literally sensual dimension of mm-hmm. of that visage. So I don't know. There's so many threads. So I started university studying English.
Mm-hmm.
Studying comparative literature and a bit of philosophy, a bit of history. And after a couple of years, I went away and I worked in the private sector for a bit. And then I came back to study what was offered under religious studies. But really, it took me some time to realize I still study literature, but I study ancient Indian Sanskrit narrative texts that have, you know, a wealth of philosophical insights. And so as a lover of literature, it's abundantly clear that being ignorant of the Tamil, but possessing a love of literature, it's abundantly clear that there is a profound richness to this poet's command of language. Yes. And all equally clear that you have painstakingly endeavored, and in my opinion, successfully, to translate the experience into English of mm-hmm. reading the Tamil. And, you know, is it fair to say that necessarily, well, I don't know, I'll leave it open. I won't assert. Would you say how much would you say is lost in translation? You know, what is that like for you? Is it such that you can arrive at a verse that you know goes a long way towards rendering the experience of reading the Tamil? Or would you say that that's not really the case?
I mean, as I said, you know, I've had to train myself. I don't know whether this is a psychological trick or what, or to make myself feel better. But because I translate a lot, I mean, I think of myself primarily as a translator. It's sort of like what I love to do, because it allows me to live in two languages simultaneously. And so I, you know, too, always, and I say this in the introduction, that I too was trained to think of translation as failure, that as did you lose something, that there's always a lack. But I have, through actually working with this text for such a long time, when you live with something, so it's very frustrating because there are times when I just think, I just can't do this. I mean, this is just impossible. I've learned and I've taught myself to reorient my thinking so that I don't think about what is lost in translation, but rather what is gained in English. What have I created in English? I feel like these two texts live in relationship to each other, where one doesn't replace the other. The English is not meant to replace the Tamil, but it serves as a kind of echo, as a kind of you know, there's this, I think of it this way. So the Sri Vaishnava commentators refer to the process of commentary as the process of immersing yourself in anubhava, right? This enjoyment. So the commentary is thought of as a text of enjoyment, as an anubhava grantha. So I think of translation in that same way. It is an anubhava grantha. It is a commentary in a way. It's independent of the text, but both rooted in the text as well. And it is a text that is my relish, my enjoyment, my experience of the text. Very much so. I definitely would say that the emotional investment that I've had in this work is unlike anything else. To the degree that I started having very intense dreams as I finished the work. Like I was constantly imagining myself as living within the poem, like literally the text of the poem. So it's a translation for me is not about lack and it's not about what is lost, but as something that I have created. That is a kind of homage, a kind of commentary, a kind of is what Walter Benjamin would refer to as an afterlife of the text. It's just one more part of it, which adds to the legacy, the richness. So I think of this text as having an endless river of anubhava with each person who encounters it. And I'm just one more stream in that endless stream. So, yeah, I don't think of it as loss. Because if I do, then this would never have been finished. I would just be stuck on verse 1
Well, it's certainly a refreshing perspective and probably useful to various creative types endeavoring to translate or write, such that, you know, what is perfect under the sun, really? And so, yet, barring the absence of perfection, certainly one can achieve a great deal, irrespective. Right. And there's so many different threads that are coming up in terms of this podcast and what hearers might be interested in, that I'm not even sure which one I want to follow. But I do want to say that there's an immersive quality. Sorry, just silence that. That I want to say that the way in which the content of the poem is of a devotee immersing himself into the experience and the contemplation of the divine. Poetry itself, great poetry, great works, great literary works, they demand that you immerse yourself into them and sort of partake in the transformation they afford. And so this, the extent to which the individual immerses themselves into the work, I think, is encapsulated in this narrative motif of authors appearing in works themselves. You learn about the author from within the contours of the work.
Yeah.
Think of the great Sanskrit epics where you have, you know, Vyasa is the author of the Mahabharata, and he's also a character, and he also, you know, has progeny in the text, and he's crucial to the, it's this interplay of sort of being a subject of the experience, right? But, and then immersing yourself into it. But it's clear, it's evident to me anyhow, that you have immersed yourself into this work. You've gone down you've sort of taken a deep dive, and you've brought back or attempted to bring back some of what you've come up with, or afforded a path whereby others can take a deep dive into this work. Is it fair to say you found this process transformative?
Oh, absolutely. There's no question that it was transformative in so many ways.
In what ways?
Transformative in how I think about translation. The slowness that it demanded of me. It made time feel function very differently. A lot of the translation I did, actually, because I'm doing a parallel project on the Festival of Recitation associated with this poem, and it has run almost concurrently and it's still ongoing. So a lot of the time I would, and the festival takes place over many, many, many hours, and so I would have time that I would just be sitting around waiting for things to happen in a temple, and I would be sitting there either reading this poem or translating. So I would say that a lot of the experience of being a part of the festival seeped in. Like, I heard the festival and the recitations that occur during the festival, and that musicality of that, the spectacular quality of the processions, the recitation of the devotees who were not part of the official formal Brahmin men reciting the text, the women who recited the text under their breath, the non-Brahmins who recited them loudly to off to the side, people sort of using the text as a way to talk about. This would happen very often when I was, you know, hanging out in the temple, where they would use the text to talk about their own relationship to God. All of that went into the. I was hearing all of that as I translated. So in some ways, it was transformative for me because the poem was not just a literary object. It had this other life. And as I said, because it took so long to do, and it's not just because it was 1,102 verses, but that it forced me to be so slow as a translator. I would work on a single verse for weeks, days, and I would just be muttering it, like walking down the road, I would just be muttering the verse and thinking about, you know, like where to, like a jigsaw puzzle, where do the words go? And that level of, I mean, I've done other translations before, but it never demanded this level of attention, this slowness of the kind of, it really slowed me down as a person. And it taught me to hear text very differently, to listen to text very differently, and to also think about English very differently. One of the things that I did in this translation, although it's in sort of free verse, I told myself that there were certain things, like because I couldn't do the Ambadi, it's not possible to replicate that in English. So I suppose that's one thing that is lost. I set myself some goals, like for instance, all the decads had to have the same number of lines. So if for instance, this one that I just read, it's all couplets. So the entire decad in English is in couplets. If I translated a particular decad, I just decided that I wanted to do four lines, then I had to do every single verse had to have four lines in that decad. So that requires a kind of discipline because it can't be artificial. I can't be just lengthening lines just because I want to fit into this arbitrary thing that I've decided, but it has to make sense. So it forced me to be it made me a much better translator, a much more thoughtful translator, a much slower and patient translator. It was very transformative I'm sure that I haven't even quite understood all the ways in which it has transformed me. But it's definitely has. And I still want to go back and work on it even though it's all done. I keep thinking back, oh, I want to do that again. I want to go back and redo that verse or redo that section. I'm not happy with it. And so it will be something that I think I will live with for my entire life.
Speaking of the sort of slow, deep nature of the translation process, it's a classic. This is a classic work. What is a classic work but a work that is so slow burning because it's speaking to parts of self that don't shift a whole lot, even in this frenetic age of ours. Mm-hmm. Right? That it's slow burning. Right? This sort of phrase I was chatting with someone earlier, a client actually, and the metaphor came, are you building a tent or are you building a pyramid? Right? Building a pyramid. It's majestic to behold. It stands the test of time. But my God, you're putting up a few bricks a day, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
This is part of Penguin Classic series.
I
think it's certainly fitting to be part of the Penguin Classic series in that this is really a classic work that is now accessible to English speakers. The work was undertaken, the translation of the work was undertaken in also the slow, methodical, epic, transformative mode whereby, you're sort of having to digest deeply the verses and the meaning and the texture and the experiences and the theology and the sociology, and then having that infuse however you decide to ultimately render the verse. I mean, there's so much there power in the translation. And it bespeaks the very depth, I feel, of human experience powering the work.
Yeah, it is. It's a remarkable work. And, one of the things that we haven't had a chance to touch on, and I sort of mentioned it very briefly, but I do want to sort of draw people's attention to this, is that one of the really marvelous things about this work, and it's very common to a lot of Bhakti poets, is the use of the female voice. And so he has almost a quarter of the verses of the Thiruvaimuri are rendered in the female voice. The voice of the mother, the voice of the friend. You have a few fortune teller here and there, and the heroine whose voice is very, very dominant. There's a couple of verses at the very end of the Thiruvaimuri, which are in the heroine's voice, but those heroines are the Gopi girls. And there's actually a pair of them. The first set of them are where the Gopi girl is speaking about the pain of separation in the evening time. And then there's a companion, a complement to that in the next 100, where she describes the Gopi girl is speaking of the parting that comes at daytime. So she says, "Don't go, Krishna," in the morning. She says, "Don't go, Krishna, because Kamsa's demons will come and get you." And it's sort of it's a beautiful kind of, it's a kind of thoughtfulness of the poet, right? So he sets the poem in this imaginal world of Vrindavan with Krishna there. And he speaks in the voice of the gopis and meditates on the uniqueness of and the difference of what separation in the evening means and what the separation that comes in day means. That there's a quality of that separation is not the same, that there is a difference. They're among my favorite verses in the poem, which is why I mentioned it.
Well, I'm very, very glad you did. What are you working on now? What's the next major project?
What's my next project? Well, there's the festival thing that I'm working on. The festival is called the Adhyayanotsavam, the Festival of Recitation. It's something I've been working on for now almost 10 years. So I'm hoping to finish that project, the field work for it, maybe in the next 2 or 3 years, depending. One doesn't know when, given the current health crisis, one doesn't know when you can actually travel. So it only takes place, it's an annual festival, it takes place only in December, January. It's 21 days long, but the festival associated with the Thiruvaimuri is the latter half of the festival. So I'm hoping to do the last bit of it this December. Hopefully everything goes well and then write that book, but I don't know what shape that will take. But I'm also working on the translation of Kamban Sundarakandam as a part of MCLI, the Multi Classical Library. It's much longer than this. It's about 1,500 verses, and I've only done 45. So you
don't collect much dust, do you?
Yeah. No, but I'm very, very slow. I'm extremely slow. So I've done only 45 verses in, I think, about 3 years of doing it.
For anyone that's read Aesop's Fables, or at least the one about the tortoise and the hare, slow and steady wins the race.
Yes. I don't know about any race being won, but I'll definitely get to the finish line. So
it's the gourmet meal over fast food then. It's yeah. Quality, right?
Exactly.
Not quantity. It has been a real pleasure speaking with you today. For those of you listening, again, we've been speaking with Dr. Archana Venkatesan from UC Davis on her extraordinarily beautiful and lucid translation of the profound Tamil poem Thiruvaimuli. I tried.
You did very well. You did very well.
And the title of the Penguin Classic translation, as you can see from the link, is "Endless Song." It is a fitting title indeed, in that both the translation and the themes that it imparts certainly will live up to being a Penguin Classic and stand the test of time. And the sonality, the flavor, the translation demands to be uttered. It is indeed a song.
Thank you so much, Raj. And would you mind if I ended by just reading a single verse?
What better way is there? Why should we talk about the food and not having taste? Yes, please.
Before I do that, I want to just thank you so much for having me and for being such a thoughtful interviewer who asked some really wonderful and very interesting questions about not just the work itself, but the process of undertaking it. I really appreciate the time and very much appreciate the opportunity to share this extraordinary poem. My hope is that with this translation, that more people will take up the study of Namarvar and the Aarvars more generally, and that this translation is only the first of many more that will come. I hope that there will be others who come forward and improve them. I know that the marvelous Vasudha Narayanan has been working on the translation of the Tiruvaimuri for, 30, 40, I think her whole life. And I'm hoping that one day her translations will see the light of day, as will Frank Clooney, who's actually the person who brought me to this project in the first place. And we were supposed to do this together. And he's got a translation as well. And I hope that that will also see the light of day sometime. And that, like all great works, that the Tiruvaimuri deserves multiple translations. So each of them can, in this kaleidoscopic way, reveal something new and different about this remarkable poem and the remarkable poet who inspired it. So by way of closing, I just want to read one verse from the 900, and this is the verse I was just talking about that is from the Decad spoken by the cowherd maidens in Vrindavan. And this is the verse, this is one of the verses where they are speaking about what parting from Krishna means when it is the evening time. So this is just one of the verses. It's from the 900. This is 995. So 900, ninth decad, fifth verse. The heart is no friend. As evening falls, the cows return and my cowherd's heart turns to stone. His flute's sweet song cuts deep in my friends. My dear companions, filled with worry for me, swoon before my eyes. Who is to protect my life? How hard it is to earn his grace.
And so you have a taste of this endless song. Until next time, keep reading, keep listening, and keep reciting aloud. Take care.
Thank you so much, Raj.